Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
They're called the greatest generation for a reason. Every generation has the potential for greatness, but few get to not only show but prove that potential in the furnace of war. But that greatest generation, so often associated with the Second World War, did have an opportunity to prove that, and certainly did. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to talk about a World War II prisoner of war, Harold Frank. Joining us to do so, Mark Hager. He's a history professor at Lenoir Rhine University, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and author of the new book, The Last of the 357th Infantry, Harold Frank's World War II Story of Faith and Courage. Mark, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, all veterans deserve our honor, but why do World War II veterans deserve special examination?
Well, this one in particular, there are so few left, especially if you deal with combat veterans from World War II, and Harold's story caught my attention because he was still very alert and could recall, you know, his past pretty decently. And when you're looking at the angle I wanted to take was, what is the secret to being a veteran myself, to the abilities that they had and resourcefulness that they showed in World War II? And that focuses a lot upon their childhood. And I had, just by sheer accident, a meeting with this man. And, you know, the flags went up immediately that I need to interview him. Quickly, I learned how important that actually was.
A big part of your telling of Harold Frank's story is the Great Depression, the influence it had on that generation. How did the hardships of the Great Depression equip these men to be outstanding soldiers, airmen, and sailors?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it began, a good friend of mine that just retired from the 82nd Airborne, as a sergeant major, he once told me, he said that in World War II, those individuals could be traced foxhole to foxhole all the way across Europe, or, you know, out in the Pacific. Very little time for any rest, no recovery back in the barracks. They had to not only fight the enemy in terms of soldiers, but in a grueling battle with all kinds of different weather issues, etc. And that is highly unusual when you compare it to the fighting that we do today. So that's what caught me with Harold. I went back to his childhood and found events that I'll let the reader understand when he was 5 years old, that immediately when I started putting the hours of communications together with him and video that I was taking, then I went, aha, I'm starting to see a picture here of the ability of resourcefulness that he learned quickly before he was even 12 years old, some of them as early as 5 and 6. You can see elements of that all through, just peppered all through his military experience, and importantly, unfortunately, when he gets captured and then has to face a grueling POW experience. And there you can see some of those same talents that he learned and resourcefulness on the farm. You can see them coming into play at that point. And so I made it important. Let's stop. I'm going to spend 5 chapters of this book at the beginning and focus on that and bring to focus that by the time he goes to basic training, all the Army does is get him regimented into drills and the new kind of equipment that he's going to be carrying. The rest of the real basic training happened from 5 to we're really 14 years of age.
So tell us a little bit about Harold Frank's childhood.
Very, very poor. I've often told Harold, when he speaks about, you know, looking today where people always want to start at the top as highest. And I said, but you need to understand when you say bottom in your house had no indoor plumbing, no heat, no heat, relatively small, the only quilts that you had from the time you were five on up until your teenage years were made of burlap sacks that your mom put together with a little bit of facing. And that was it. And then you had straw tick beds, things that when you mention being at the bottom, even though for Harold and his generation and many of the people around him, they thought that was normal because so many were in that shape. And there's no Lowe's hardware. There's no 84. I mean, there's no Southern States or any place to go to get your supplies. They had to learn to replicate from blacksmithing to you name it on that farm every day to meet whatever farming needs that were going to happen. And so you can see that in Harold to where by the time he's 10, 12 years old, when something breaks, he didn't have to go and run to his dad, who was really busy himself, or his uncle that were all around there. He could go in and start fixing things himself right then and there. But it's because there was no money when he's learning to shoot. And he does get a BB gun at one point, but he can only shoot at something for target practicing that he could go back and retrieve the BBs from, because that's all he's going to have. And so his reliance on simple things, such as building the proper slingshot, he masters by the time he's six, and they need it to try to get whatever extra food that they could find on the farm. So that's going to help save his life when he is in a POW camp later on. Those are just some of the snippets. But you'll see how the farm itself, they can look at things that are no longer working and then study it for a little while and see how they can turn it into something that will work on something else. That's the result of partly poverty, which creates an acute awareness to be resourceful. And there's no complaining. There's no time for it. With him, his oldest sister, who worked closely together, there's just that's just reality.
You also point out that, as you said before, really all the Army did for him in basic training was to put the proper weapon in his hand. He was a rifleman, and that early life of handling a weapon held him in very good stead, didn't it?
Yes. As being a rifleman, that's a BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle, which in the military we called a, we always referred to it as a badass rifle, but in the civilian world they like to call it a Browning Automatic Rifle. But when he was a child and first learned to shoot, before he could take the weapon out to actually hunt, he had to first know how to take it apart and understand how it works so that they could fix anything if it should malfunction. And so he carried that when he went into the Army. And when a sergeant came up and said, this is a BAR, can shoot several hundred rounds per minute, would anyone like to volunteer? His hand was up before anyone else to grab it. And so the first thing he did was, when they handed the rifle and then the manual for it, he memorized it. And within about a week, week and a half, he learned how to take it completely apart, put it back together over and over and over to where he could do it blindfolded, and then took it to the range and became the best shot in the 271st Infantry. So that's a little bit about how he was. They tried to get him to stay stateside to train people on the BAR, but he refused and said that's not the reason why he was in the military. It was to go and fight. And so he and a few other, the BAR men, the 271st, were pulled abruptly. They didn't know why. And given a furlough, which you'll read about in the book, and then after that, they find themselves on a troop ship out of New York after being at Camp Shanks, and they're being prepared for the Normandy invasion. And those BAR men were going to be attached to the 90th Division, but they're replacements. They're waiting as soon as action starts when they land. And he excels at that and then trains people in England on the BAR before that. And so it's just a neat perspective on what happens when you take somebody who goes through that much training and that experience growing up and resourcefulness to where they can constantly take a piece of equipment and make it better.
Harold was raised a Lutheran. How did that form his faith in life?
Growing up in the Great Depression, when people think of this area of North Carolina, that, you know, it's naturally known as the Bible Belt. And there's actually some comical stuff within that, because growing up Baptist myself, I can remember, perhaps you all, I'm not sure exactly where you all are located, but remember when every county in the South was basically a dry county and it had nothing to do with weather. And the blue laws that were passed. But if you were Lutheran, though, that was the exception. They were allowed to drink, but it was in moderation, as they would say. And the Frank family were really good at turning around any grapes, strawberries especially, and turning it into a wine. At one point, during the height of the Great Depression, they couldn't afford the communion wine at the Lutheran church, so they used, I called it the Frank vintage, to help with communion. But nevertheless, no matter how hard the work was, Monday through Saturday, if they had to work later on Saturday, they did, just because there was no reason to miss church at all on Sunday. That's just the way it was in the Frank family and for the families all around them, that they were not allowed to miss church. And so he was expected to be there, and he didn't know anything otherwise. He was going to be there all the time. When he goes to basic, his mom gives him a Bible, which I now have, and which would be carried with him all through the war and his POW experience, where he, when he's captured, he tears apart his shaving kit because it had at least some waterproofing in it to make sure he put his Bible in it so nothing would happen to it while he's there. So that, and plus he continually will tell people, and interview after interview, that normally when the fighting got intense or things got really bad in the POW camps, that he says, I could feel my mama's prayers. And that stuck with him, to where even some of the men around him, if he suddenly woke up, they would say, is she praying? He said, yes, sir. She is. I can feel it. And that's a little bit, but the book will go even into more detail on some of that.
Why did Harold, at his induction, why did he choose the Army?
His dad was very concerned, because Harold wanted to be a Marine. And his dad, who he listened to fervently, was listening, and I guess that would be in 1943, as developments in the Guadalcanal area were taking place, and the casualties that were occurring with the Marines. But he told Harold, he says, son, whatever you do, don't join the Marines. And then Harold would often say, you know, his biggest weakness growing up in Western North Carolina was he's not the best swimmer. He can swim some, so he didn't want to join the Navy. So when they looked at him, when he passed his physical to go in, they said, you can be anything you want to be. And he basically said those stories to them and then stood on the footprints of the Army. And they said, well, we're glad to have you. And that's how he chose the Army.
We are getting a biography of World War II prisoner of war, Harold Frank, with Mark Hager, author of The Last of the 357th Infantry. On the other side, we'll hear about Frank's training. You can meet and hear Bill Barr, Albert Moeller, Pavi Rossinen, Chris Roseborough, Brian Wolfmiller, Joel Bierman, and Will Whedon at the 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 24th and Saturday, June 25th in Chicago. For more information, visit IssuesETC.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 24th and 25th at Concordia University, Chicago.
America's tradition of liberty depends on having colleges and universities that equip young people for the responsibilities of freedom. At Concordia University Chicago, freedom is a pillar of our education. We prepare our students to live as free, self-governing citizens. I'm Dr. Rachel Ferguson, Director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia Chicago. I invite you to visit us. Discover what it means for freedom to become a pillar of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Many educational institutions are governed by the whims of culture and are increasingly hostile to the Word of God. In contrast, Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, provides classical Lutheran education rooted in God's Word for students preschool through grade 12. Simply put, we equip students to stand firm in the faith through solid education focused on wisdom and virtue. We offer in-person instruction as well as live online classes for remote learning. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're getting a biography of World War II prisoner of war, Ward Harold Frank. Mark Hager is our guest. Mark, you talked a little bit about it before, but tell us more about Harold's training.
His training, basic training, would be in Camp Shelby, Mississippi. It was intense. It was a reactivation of the 69th Infantry Division that was moved into that, to where when they went to basic, it's not like my basic training back in the mid-80s. Their basic training, they trained as a whole division, so they knew everybody. And they trained for over a year. And just about every aspect of you could imagine in combat, Harold excelled in all of it. Didn't have any problems. His major battle was, I called it in the book, he had a huge problem with the leaves of three, which would be like poison oak, poison ivy, those things that got him into trouble several different times down in Camp Shelby, Mississippi. Got him in the hospital, but afterwards, beyond that, he excelled. He had amazing stories. Some of the people that he became close to, he tried to help his best friend at basic training to learn to read and write, who didn't know how. He's from Georgia, and it's very comical because he would have to write his letters, and some of them were to his best friend's girlfriend, who he trusted Harold enough to say anything that they wanted to say back and forth with. And there's that, and lots of other information about using and training with the BAR, amphibious training, and how long that they would train as road marching in that part of the southeast, sometimes 90-mile road march, which that's pretty extensive, but that was their preparation to be moving across Europe.
You mentioned the Normandy invasion. What was that like for Harold?
One of the most confusing parts of the story, because when Harold and his assistant gunner, that's Paul Esworthy, are on troop ships and preparing for the Normandy invasion, leaving out of England, the terms, when you think of D-Day, D-Day plus one, D-Day plus two, D-Day plus three, all these ships are already en route and moving, and each one is scheduled to land at a certain time. Harold tries to forget the 30 days of combat that he had. Well, much of his war experience he chose to forget about, and his wife of 68 years would plead with him to tell some of his story, but he didn't. He didn't want her to know just how bad things were, so he had been forgetting it for many years, and then she passed away back in 2016, just before I met Harold. And he had one little book that came out on the 357th Infantry, and he was trying to reconfigure what had happened somewhat. So he knew that some of the 357th came in on D-Day itself, but they're only there not to fight, but to set up operations for the entire division to move in the next few days after D-Day. And their operation was to come in behind the 4th Infantry. The 4th Infantry Division would turn and head towards the only major deep water port in the Côte d'Ivoire Peninsula, that's Cherbourg. And then to protect them, the 90th would move straight across the Côte d'Ivoire and block any German attempts either of reinforcing Cherbourg or for Germans trying to get out of Cherbourg. So they're going to be fighting on two sides. And it's intense. And trying to go day by day with Harold and remembering what it was like to be in that kind of hail was perhaps, we still have 2 days that we can't quite locate exactly where he is. So that's where he realized some came in on the 6th of June, and the bulk of them came in on the 10th, and that's where they got their combat infantry badge. So he's been all over the place as to which time he actually arrived. So my best point that I can get is somewhere between the 10th and 12th. He is there, and they move forward to the Lafayette Causeway at the St. Mary Glise, past St. Mary Glise, famous bridge where the 82nd was trying its hardest to hold out for 4 days, and the 90th Division arrives. That's their first really big pitched battle, which is kind of like Amfreville when you're watching Saving Private Ryan. They arrive just at the nick of time to hold that bridge and get across the Merdaret River. And it was somewhere right in that time period that Harold, as a replacement, is thrust forward with Paul Esworthy as his assistant gunner with his BAR, since they are the only machine gun in an infantry squad. And he goes into combat at that point and then stays that way for the next 30 days through the Battle of Hill 22, the Battle of Gourbeville, and then several patrols that some of them are at night, and then eventually the Battle of Boucadray, which was the heaviest fighting that the 90th would face. And by that time, they've had 115% casualties, so even the replacements that came in early are now the veterans.
So obviously it was in chaos. After the storming of Utah Beach, I think is where he landed. How did he describe that experience to you? What kind of stories did he tell you?
The best way would be describing it as a kind of a hail. You're thrown into a unit that has been decimated, but you don't know the names. And the ranks, they're tore off their uniforms anyway because they don't want Germans to identify them for sharpshooters and such. So you don't really know names except for Paul. That's the only one that he knows. So as they move forward, that creates some of its own confusion at first. And then after crossing the bridge at Merdaret, you know, that's where he runs into seeing the gliders, the glider infantry regiments, and passing by gliders in which everyone in it is dead already. And then seeing the chutes of the 82nd, 101st paratroopers who were killed before they ever even hit the ground, still hanging, that and the scenes of death all around them with other men. And again, you're fighting in terms of feet each day because it took about 7 weeks for them to go 17 miles into the interior. And so for any combat veteran, I've kind of stressed with other veterans that if you're interviewing somebody that you know was in combat, be very careful because they spend a lot of time trying to forget it. But every now and then these events pop out, and some of them are Germans in those bunkers in the hedgerows that on several occasions, you know, they would have to gun down other people that came out with them. Several occasions there were women that came out of those bunkers and would grab rifles trying to shoot at them. And some of those stories I had not quite heard. I mean, I knew at the end of the war they took a lot of the women that were fraternizing with the Nazis. You know, they had their heads shaved and such. But hear some of these stories from Harold was kind of unusual. So that kind of combat, you'll read more into that as you read this book, and then also when he gets captured. One of the things I hope people realize is that you don't really hear stories about what it was like at the moment you're captured, what the Germans did to you from that point to where you finally make it to a POW camp, which in Harold's case was Stalag 4B, which was up at Dresden. So he's going to survive the 1,000-plane bombing of Dresden towards the end of the war also.
How did Harold Wirst kill in combat?
He was the BAR man in an infantry squad is usually heading the patrol. He's up front. Sometimes the assistant gunner is nearby, but Harold found that he wanted his assistant gunner to fall back so he's not right beside him. And that's just close order combat training at that point. But as they move forward, they come under kind of an enfilade fire. And that was right after St. Mary Glees, crossing the Merritt River, heading towards what would become the town of Gourbeville or Equivenaville, another French town, not much there, still not much there today. And as he's moving forward, he comes under fire. He falls into a crater coming from our Allied fire, coming from ships still out in the channel. And when he comes up on one side, he's able to look towards a firing position of a German machine gun nest and fires an entire mag into them until none of them are moving. And it's kind of a surreal moment because when he finishes that, he just realized he's killed his first persons, several of them. And then he hears someone yelling and yelling and yelling, finally cussing at him. And he turns, and it was the sergeant that put him into the unit. And he's ordering him to move out of that crater. And so he does and grabs his assistant gunner and falls into another crater just as the one he was in was blown up. German 88 shell hit and realized, you know, that guy knows what he's doing. So he would be listening more and not as much of that kind of thinking, but fighting and moving constantly, not staying in one spot. Then he realized that if you were a BAR man, German forward observers would be able to home in on whoever was the machine gunner, and that's another one they tried to bring in like 88 rounds or whatever on. So he constantly tried to fight in a way to where they didn't know exactly where he was. And that was his initiation into combat.
How was he wounded in battle?
What happens with Harold is right around Independence Day, July the 4th, roughly a month after the D-Day landings, the 357th, what's left of it, is supposed to fall back and then finally get some time for shower, hot meal, complete new equipment, which they badly need, everything from clothing up. And en route to do that, also with some elements of the 82nd who were allowed to come back and rest for a day or two, well, they end up in a railroad cut in which they capture 17 Germans in that spot, and which slowed them down. They finally get back, and they get showered up and get one night's rest, and he's eating. And during that time, an NCO came up and said that two of the companies, the I&L company, they have lost contact with, and they may have been overrun. And him and Paul, being the two most experienced BAR men at that time, they asked for them to come back and help lead a patrol, which they do, to try to locate them. So they do that during the night, and it's raining all through the night. And he has an encounter with a German at one point and moves on past that. And at daybreak, they come across a road. It's a hardtop road, and they quietly try to move across, and then a German machine gun nest opens up and cuts the patrol in two, and Harold and two others are on one side of the road, and Paul Esworthy and the other men are on the other. And what they didn't realize was the German 16th Parachute Infantry Regiment was just one of a whole bunch of German units that had been massing and leading an attack to try to throw everybody back onto the beaches. So Harold basically finds himself behind enemy lines with just a few people left. They do make contact with a couple of survivors of I&L Company and end up having to fight 9 hours. And in that process, gets shot in the shoulder with an armor-piercing round that somehow doesn't go through him. and continues to fight until they run out of ammo. German tank units are actually redeployed back, thinking that they had already cleared that area out, which inadvertently he has slowed down, him and those few survivors slowed down some of that German advance. And at that point, they tried to fall out of it. The guy next to him was shot in the leg, and his leg was fractured. And he's trying to carry him and get across a flooded field back to where they thought Allied lines was. And when they crawl out, it's a German from the 16th Parachute Infantry Regiment with an MP-40 there standing that captures him.
We're talking about World War II prisoner of war, Harold Frank. Mark Hager is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin, your link to Issues, Etc. If you have a family member, a friend, or a congregant in your church who serves in the U.S. military, be sure to enroll them in the Ministry by Mail program. Military members receive a welcome packet with spiritual resources, including portals of prayer. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Ministry by Mail is an outreach of the LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces. On the other side, what was life like as a POW in Dresden?
Solid, serious, substantive. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Times of war have caused people throughout history to ask questions about the existence of God and the existence of evil. And yet we must confess that even amidst the terrors of war, God remains God. Nothing happens that he does not, at the very least, allow. If you've wondered these very things, especially as you've watched the war in Ukraine, you might find some of the answers you're looking for in the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness, Church and State in a Time of War. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe, or our website witness.lcms.org to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of his family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in his ways.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. Mark Hager, author of the new book, The Last of the 357th Infantry, Harold Frank's World War II story of faith and courage, is our guest. In about 15 minutes, we'll discuss Lutherans, civil authorities, and war with Dr. Cameron McKenzie. So, Mark, tell us what life was like as a prisoner of war there near Dresden.
Well, first, when you read in the book, wait till you experience what the train ride was like for those POWs, which was horrendous, and things that the cruelty that they did to them, and when they would offload and go through some of the small communities, etc. But when he finally gets to the first POW camp, he says it's basically everyone is ate up with lice. There's little food. It's more of a porridge, and the water was not fit to be drunk. And he was moved from that first one and got back on a train and taken to another similar one, which was Stalag 4B up in Dresden. And when he gets in there, he hears people at night saying, "We're going to die here," and some of them did. So he would try to overcome those urges, and then recognizes when a German comes in looking for a work detail, that him and three other guys, and they're all from the south, that's four of them, decide it can't be any worse than this. So they do, and they're taken closer to Dresden to a Messerschmitt airfield called Klotzsche Airfield, which they are forced to work in a kind of like a paper mill, in which they're getting the pulpwood for it, stacking it, and then moving it into the inside where it's turned around into whatever they're going to make out of it. And they work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, no matter the weather. And which he describes, he got better food there, which was a Well, I'll let you read about that in the book. It's when he says better, wait till you read what better was. Not much.
You mentioned the 1,000-plane bombing of Dresden. Was that a danger to the POWs?
They were allowed to put POW on top of the building, paint it, when they got there. But when I look at the images that I got from the 8th Air Force, the Mighty 8th Air Force Museum down in Savannah, Georgia, I just find it hard to believe that they could actually see that building, especially the firebombing begins at night anyway. And he sees the flare drop, which that helped me to identify where the airfield was, because the Mighty 8th sent me a kind of a flight diagram showing where the flare dropped was where they were to turn. And they were to turn at that point, and then they knew they were within so much area of their targets to, you know, let the bombs fly. So I doubt they could see the POW on it, but it escaped it. But by April 1945, the POW building was still there, but the airfield itself was obliterated, and all the planes there were made useless.
How long was he there as a POW?
About 10 months.
Tell us about the evacuation of the POW camp.
As Russian forces are moving closer and closer, of course, they didn't know at first, you know, over the 10-month period. It wasn't till towards the end that they could really hear artillery getting closer. And, of course, they didn't have much knowledge of what was happening, but Harold felt when he first started seeing American bombers coming by, and then he noticed that they had fighter support, that meant to him that they're moving closer. So the war's going well. And one of the German supervisors, a civilian, Harold learned to speak German pretty quickly. And he would pull him aside and tell anybody, but would try to give him a little bit of what was really happening in the war. So that's about as close as he knew. Of course, his mom is able to finally get some letters. And I've got those letters, and of course, they're in the book. But they're very generic. You're not allowed to say much of anything, but you can see by the date of the letters and some of the comments in it to where reading into it, you knew they were coincided with certain big events that were happening in Europe and that the home front, everything was going really good. So it kind of gives you a mindset that things are looking up. So he felt positive, but as he heard Russian artillery, he really didn't want to be captured by the Russians, and the Germans didn't want to be captured by the Russians, of course. So, and then after the bombing of Dresden, everything was ruins, and they were ordered to be evacuated from the work camp. And that first evacuation, they walked day and night, no stop, not for water, not for food, not for anything, for 4 straight days. And at one point, he's sleepwalking, and a horse that's behind him, every time he would stop, would he would feel it starting to nudge his back, and he would then keep moving again and watch Germans also, by the thousands, were also evacuating out. He does have one escape attempt, in which he's recaptured after 5 days, but that was more or less how the evacuation happens, and they keep moving and moving and moving, and eventually towards Czechoslovakia and then back down into Germany, in which he noticed the guards one day, they changed their uniforms, came out in civilian clothes, and said, on May the 7th, Germany had surrendered for them to go. And, of course, they didn't know if it was a trick or what, but eventually they did slowly start moving forward and then met part of Patton's 3rd Army, a sergeant that was in a Jeep, who recognized them and told them to stop and just rest, sit down, and they ordered trucks up to pick him up. From there, he's taken to Camp Lucky Strikes.
How did he eventually return home?
From Camp Lucky Strikes, they can't really feed them. It was one of the problems with the POWs. You know, he had lost 92 pounds, and you can't just feed them a meal. They would throw it all back up. So, and the medics would try to work on them for a while, but eventually General Eisenhower had actually come into see the POWs, and the tent that he happened to walk into is the one with Harold, and actually had chow with Harold and some of the others right there. It was an interesting encounter in which told them that they were going to be able to call home and took them to where they could in line, and Harold was able to call and let the only one in his family had a phone, his oldest sister, be able to hear him, in which was lots of excitement. And it didn't take long. From there, they boarded troop ships, and they were allowed to have the lights back on, and came back to New York, got on a train, and was in Fort Bragg shortly thereafter. And then from Fort Bragg, got a new set of clothes, etc., because technically he's not out of the Army. He's given a furlough to come home, and gets on a bus that takes him to Lexington, North Carolina, in which he happens when it's late at night when he arrives, and a man that he knew happened to be taking his daughter, who was on her way to school, and recognized Harold and said, "You're not going to be paying for this. I'm going to drive you back home." And so after midnight, he's walking down his farm drive. His two dogs that he was raised with, first barking and growling, come running up, and then recognize them and knocks on the door, and it's his mom that opens the door. And that's how his 34 months of combat ends.
What was life like for Harold after the war?
Pretty tough. They couldn't figure out what to do about his eating, and they knew he had to. And he had an uncle who was in World War One, who didn't talk about it until Harold came back. And then they would sometimes just sit and talk together, which kind of helped with recovering back to the civilian world. But he eventually sent to Memphis, Tennessee, to U.S. Army Hospital there, in which they work on him and other POWs coming from Europe. And ironically, that's where he sees the first of the Americans that were in the Pacific Theater that had been captured. And they arrive, and as bad as what he was, he couldn't believe what he was witnessing that the Japanese had done. And there they work with Harold. It was basically they feed him 5 or 6 times, just using enough food to cover just the palm of your hand. And then he found that peanuts and a couple other things kind of worked, and it was really meeting his wife when he came back home, who, when they were dating and then when they got married, who basically tried to figure out what would work, what wouldn't work, and so credits her and his faith for keeping him alive and then getting him back to normal. It took years, about 10 years.
Why are so many of those who serve in combat, as you had mentioned, hesitant, and in some cases unwilling to discuss their experiences in war?
Well, I've dealt with that, and I've tried to explain to people when they can't get their exact dates in which they had this action or that action happen, why they can't. And the only way I can phrase that is that it's kind of like, without any real notice, you're thrown into hell with a bunch of other people. And then you're trying to fight your way out of it, if there is a way out of it. And then when you get back, people ask you the names of the people you were with while you were in hell. And you don't know. You don't really want to know. A guy that was with Patton, a tanker that I know that's still alive and doing well, he would say even he couldn't tell you the name of the town they were in, the day of the week it was. Only thing he was concerned about was this tank and the men that were in it, and then his mind was off anything else. Harold, as an infantryman, was the same way. So those kinds of events, when you arrive in combat, that is so graphic all around you, the people that he lost, and seeing a mortar team set up near him, and some desperate fighting around Gourbeville, and when they set up, they didn't know they were over a landmine, so the first mortar out, and then sets off the mine, and there's nothing left of them. And things like that, when he does break loose on those things, he will look at you and say, "I'm going to have nightmares over this now." So they try to push those memories away and not bring them back. I even had one veteran, Well, one, I think it was his grandson, said that when the movie Saving Private Ryan came out, and he was excited and wanted to take his grandfather, who was there on D-Day, to go see it. And he would look at him and say, why in the hell would I want to go back and remember that? So that's a good impression on many of these veterans, that many of them are drafted. They don't want to remember combat. They just want to get home and move on. And you find some of that aspect all through the book.
Finally, how did Harold reflect upon the role of his faith in his combat experiences?
Oh, without it, he says that he wouldn't have made it. Without feeling that his family, their close-knit, and his church, and others, he just knew, he could feel it, that they were praying every day, and he would wake up and saying, I'm not going to die here. I'm going to go home. I'm going to get home somehow. And so then he would pray, read when he could, and you can see marks in the Bible, and also where he wrote in the names of the people who were in the camp with him. You can see each of those things in there to understand how strong he felt his faith was and how strong it needed to be.
Mark Hager is history professor at Lenoir Rhine University. He's an award-winning documentary filmmaker and author of the new book, The Last of the 357th Infantry, Harold Frank's World War II Story of Faith and Courage. You can purchase this book at issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Mark, thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you.
Up next, Dr. Cameron McKenzie of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, joins us to talk about Lutherans, civil authorities, and war. Issues Etc. guests are frequent contributors to the Lutheran Witness magazine. The Lutheran Witness is a must-have resource for every Issues Etc. listener. You can receive an annual print and digital subscription for less than $20. Learn more at cph.org/witness or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Interpreting the world from a Lutheran perspective, the Lutheran Witness magazine, cph.org/witness or 1-800-325-3040.
Making Disciples for Life. Across the nation, students are back in school in over 1,800 schools serving children in early childhood through high school. Students are thriving in programs of excellence in a safe, caring, Christian environment taught by dedicated teachers. To find a school in your community, visit lcms.org/schools. Connect today for information about a Lutheran school for the children in your family at lcms.org/schools.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Memoria Press's award-winning Latin programs are designed to teach your student to master Latin grammar through an easy-to-use step-by-step process. By studying Latin, your student will gain an academic vocabulary, a mastery of English grammar, and develop sound critical thinking skills. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next purchase by using the coupon code LPR22. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. memoriapress.com.